Hello, and welcome to another awards interview edition of Awards Daily's Water Cooler Podcast. I'm your host, Clarence Moy, and today I'm bringing you an interview with the supervising sound editor of Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, Wiley Stateman. Now, this is a really fascinating conversation, unfortunately only half of which you're going to be able to hear because he offered a chance for me to go off the record so that we could talk about things offline. And I took that opportunity, and that conversation is really great, but that conversation's going to remain between me and Wiley. But what you'll hear is his conversation with me about the steps he took toward creating a sound design for Quentin Tarantino's Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. This 8-time Oscar nominee has worked with such huge directors like Cameron Crowe and Wolfgang Peterson and Oliver Stone and the great John Hughes. And here he talks about working with Quentin and how he likes to work with writer, directors, and producers who have a holistic view and a holistic picture of the output that they want to create. Pay special attention to the section in which he talks about the sound design for the Spawn Ranch scene. And then go back and watch that scene again in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, which is now available for streaming, and see if you don't watch that scene completely differently than you did the first time that you saw it in the theater. And just as a reminder, we are continuing to produce podcasts and interviews throughout Oscar season here at Awards Daily. And again, at the end of this podcast, it does stop rather abruptly, again, because I went offline and off the record to talk to him more because he was such a fantastic interview. So thank you for listening, and be sure to follow us still on awardsdaily.com as we bring you more interviews throughout Oscar season.
Hello.
Hi, is this Wiley?
Yes, it is.
Hey, hi. Wiley. This is Clarence Moy with Awards Daily. How are you?
Hello, Clarence. I'm good.
Excellent.
Yeah, really, really good. And thank you so much for thinking of me and reaching out. And I very much appreciate it. I like your columns. So.
Oh, thank you very much. Thank you. No, this is a huge pleasure. I was looking over your IMDb and your Wikipedia just to get a better sense of your work outside of Once Upon a Time, and I just realized you've been working on the sound for like almost most of my favorite movies for the past 20 years. So this is definitely an honor for me as well. So thank you. So looking at your resume, you're obviously, you know, you've worked with a lot of different directors. You've worked on a lot of different types of projects, but you know, looking at some of the directors that you've worked with, like Oliver Stone and Quentin and Wolfgang Peterson, you know, they're very intense and they produce very intense films. What do you look for out of a director, to make sure that you have the best experience or the best possible collaboration?
Yeah, I work almost exclusively with writer, director, producer types. Mm-hmm. They're my favorite kind of filmmakers. They've got the big picture in mind. They have the authority to make, you know, judgment calls from the trenches. They know their characters. It's like I can't say enough about the writer, director combination as the absolute sweet spot. And I would say writer, director, producer, because, you know, this is kind of a unique thing maybe for Los Angeles, for Hollywood, for American filmmaking, that we actually have the type of people that can fill those three roles. Primarily, I think first as a writer and then of course as a director, but as a producer as well. It's the power trio that is really exciting to me, working with people that know what they want, know how they're, you know, or at least have some thought as to how they will achieve that. Mm-hmm. And then their hands on the resources necessary in order to do things right. You know, so primarily if you look at my history, it's multiple projects with the same three or four. I did 15 movies with John Hughes,
right?
You know, so all those comedies were just, you know, taught me about comedy and timing and humor and how to make people laugh. And, you know, the funny thing is music is so important. And you learn about music from, you know, from the writer, director, producer types as well. And so whether it's the use of songs, like what we did in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, you know, this is a film driven by songs and KHJ radio. Mm-hmm. You know, it's the backbone of the soundtrack. And Quentin had these songs very much in mind the entire time he was writing. So it's really wonderful to work with a director like, you know, Quentin, who's got in his head the sort of the sound of the era and you know, clearly songs that will drive the characters. And then as a sound designer and supervising sound editor, working with songs already in place is just like it's a huge advantage, and it allows us to prototype against not just a proxy, but the actual, actual music that we'll be working to all the way through the process.
Yeah, so let's talk about usage of the songs in the film a little bit more. So, you know, you're right, music is prevalent in the entire film. It is a part of the LA at the time and you know, with all the period songs used there. When you look at, like, a scene with, you know, one of the scenes with Brad Pitt driving around in that car and the songs are playing in through the stereo, how do you record that? Is that a separate channel that's played off on the side and made to sound muted like it's coming through stereo, or is it actually played through the car and then you pick it up on the same mic that way to give it more of an authentic sound? How do you manage that?
Yeah, the music is selected in the cutting room. In pre-production, Quentin selected most of the music and KHJ radio. From, you know, Quentin went through and listened to literally hundreds of hours of KHJ file audio archives and air checks and you know, really spent time getting to refamiliarize himself with Humble Harv and the real Don Steele. And so he had in mind the radio, but during production, you know, Mark Ulano, he's responsible for recording the dialogue. Mm-hmm. And in a scene where Brad Pitt's just driving his car, I think you're talking about the scene where Brad Pitt leaves Rick Dalton's house and he goes home to his house, his trailer by the drive-in to feed his dog, Brandy.
Right.
So there's no, there wasn't music playing in those driving scenes.
Oh.
There's really no reason to do that. The actor really, you know, he was driving the car himself, so he had to really focus on, you know, bobbing and weaving in and out of character, out of traffic. You know, he had to focus on safety, really. So Brad's focusing on safety and trying to work the camera that's in a camera car. And, you know, and look good doing it. And the music is then added in the cutting room. So Jim Schultz, who was the music editor, you know, he would quickly prototype those songs. And then we would model the car sounds around that.
Okay.
So if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, it does. And you have to sort of degrade the quality of the music just a little bit to make it sound like it's coming through a car stereo out of the 60s.
Yeah, and there's so many, there's all kinds of sound modeling tools now in software that give us the chance to both define the texture of the music and make it feel more period, and the acoustical space, whether we're in the car or behind the car or the car is passing by us, we have these wonderful modeling tools to acoustically impose on the music our will.
Sure. So you've worked with Quentin for his last 7 films, and you talked earlier about, you know, being directors who are writer, producer, director, appealing to you, just your personal aesthetic. Aside from that, what is it about Quentin's vision that makes you two work so well together?
You know, I think that Quentin loves the craft of filmmaking, and sound is an important part of his thought process. So he's thinking about sound when he's writing. He's thinking about sound when he's shooting. And clearly when he's in the cutting room, sound helps him inform the pacing and the time shifting that he often does in his films. So what's wonderful about Quentin is that he has the sensibility to reshape time and then use sound to either punctuate those changes or to fill in sometimes some of the gaps. So there's a good example of this. We have a flashback of Brad Pitt in the boat, and he's being berated by his wife. And the scene is sort of truncated with a piece of sound design that transitions us and leaves the end of that scene with some question about how and what happened in that story. So, and I think Quentin, another example of that is the scene where Leonardo's having his breakdown in the trailer.
Right.
So you have a series of cuts and jump cuts to kind of get him, he's advancing his hysteria and his anxiety with, a lot of, choppy bits of dialogue. But to inform the pacing of that, you really have to be listening to the dialogue, listening to how he's thrashing the inside of that trailer. And that really helps get the cutting pace to make sense. So Quentin often considers sound for its benefits in terms of informing picture timing and scene, the entrance or the conclusion of a scene.
Fascinating. So when you're looking at a period piece like Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, which is so closely tied to the late 60s, particularly in scenes where you're out on the streets, right? You're in like when Brad Pitt picks up Margot Qualley, and you've got so much surrounding noise. Is there a concern that you need to find something that's sort of authentic to the period, and how do you go about satisfying that need, given that it is you don't want to throw somebody out of, whether they're conscious of it or not, you don't want to throw somebody out of the film with a sound that just doesn't necessarily work for a 1969 set film?
Yeah. I always work from the big picture. So, when we start a film like this, Quentin and the sound team, Mark Ulano and Mike Minkler and I, we have detailed discussions about authenticity, I guess is what you're saying.
Yep.
But authenticity doesn't play a role everywhere. It just needs to be focused where it makes, where it would make a difference to the audience. So, the street scene that you're talking about is filled with vintage cars and things that will, give it a visual authenticity. And that, is substantial enough to carry 1969. The places where sound plays a role is, maybe more like, with a car, a driving scene where, like the MG going to the Playboy Mansion, mm-hmm. Or the Carmen Ghia, there are driving scenes where the car is a real player, but that particular scene is about Margot and it's about the music and it's about this wonderful realization that, our paths have crossed again. And that's all performance. That's all, Brad Pitt and Margot, cars are not there to make a statement. The cars are just way supporting that scene, way in the distance supporting that scene. So when I say that there's the big picture, there are moments where sound really matters to support authenticity. And then there are moments where it's all about how does the scene feel and how do we make sure that the dialogue is presented and the music is presented with as much acoustical space as possible. So the movie Once Upon a Time in Hollywood is much more of an exercise in punctuation and in time shifting and location shifting mm-hmm. than it is one of authenticity. So
yeah,
I don't know if that really matters to you or to the voice that, you know, your audience, but I am not afraid to play something extremely quiet.
Right.
The hallmark of films that I'm proud of are very articulate and very in some ways they're built around story and they're built around sort of an emotional feel rather than any desire for abject authenticity. I mean, I think if we capture the emotion, we've done what we need in order to make a film authentic. And the emotion isn't just happy or sad. It's tension. It's it's release. It's it's changing locations. You know, as beautifully as the picture is cutting from one location to another, the sound needs to have could have a voice in that process. So it's a very holistic view, and that's why I like the writer directors, because they have that holistic view. They have the big picture in mind, and they're often focused on flow and story and character development. Those are the things I think that truly make sound design interesting. I mean, when we arrive at the Spawn Ranch, you know, Quentin said, I can't imagine a song that could speak to the evil of this place. And so Brad's walk up to George Spawn's house is all done with sound design and natural textures, wind, and the way the camera dodges behind a truck and then reveals them walking by again. All of those camera moves we created a vocabulary for. So, you know, when the camera goes into hiding for just a second and then reveals the wider shot, we have, you know, developed a sound vocabulary that that helps describe the feeling of that and the magic and mystery of that. So I think the George Spawn Ranch is a really fantastic opportunity to play with sound, providing sort of the evil and the despair that's underlying the story in those scenes.
Yeah. Well, when you do you carry that, then do you relay any of the same sonic influences on a scene like the end, where it's Tarantino's version of the Manson family attacks, such as they are in the film? How do you set the tone for that scene through sound?
Yeah, I one other thing about the George Spawn scene, you know, that rat in the glue trap is just, it's just, you know, you have this long lingering walk-in, you have the scene with Dakota Fanning through the screen door. I mean, this is really intense, you know, toe-to-toe filmmaking, where you have the John Wayne generation meeting the Easy Rider generation. You know, this film, this is a buddy movie, but it's also very much the conflict between, you know, the kind of buddy movie that Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid was in 1969 and the movie Easy Rider. It's like the clash between those two worlds. And so there's nothing more interesting than having the Spawn Ranch scene where that plays completely out. You know, I mean, to me that is a milestone in filmmaking. The arrival at Spawn Ranch, the scene with Dakota Fanning and then Bruce Dern and then the fight, you know, the guy that he forces to change his tire, the fight, and then his exit with the horse chasing back, you know, the tension of Tex riding for what might be a climactical opus ending to that scene, and then we end up with just the Cadillac driving off and KHJ radio playing. It's 5 o'clock in Los Angeles. You know, I mean, like that to me, Spahn Ranch is what makes this movie a Quentin Tarantino movie. The final scene could have been, you know, it's also part of his vocabulary, but it is much more, you know, that is much more about the sweet revenge. That's like the third act climax, which ties revenge to the story. But in terms of filmmaking chops, you know, sound plays a much more distinctive role, I think, in some of the earlier scenes. You know, I think there's a really distinctive moment for sound in the Lancer set, you know, when Leonardo loses his dialogue. You know, the whole scene is played opposite of what you would expect. So normally when somebody says, and action, camera, roll, sound, you know, everything gets quiet. People don't make a noise. They don't move. You know, all construction stops. But in our movie, everything is like a finished soundtrack. It's got, you hear the ceiling fan beating away, you hear spurs and boots on Foley on the ground, and you have this wonderful Western, you know, thing playing out in full sound, you know, sound design. And then all of a sudden, when he forgets his lines, it goes opposite. Now the whole world drifts away with his memory. And when he calls for the script supervisor to read the line in, the world is just silent. The world, his world has abandoned him. And all of that is told through sound, opposite, I think, of what reality is. So when I guess what I'm saying, Clarence, is when you talk about reality, for me, it's not the cars in a street scene. It's the it's the play for or the play against reality in a scene like the Lancer set with Leonardo dropping his dialogue. I don't know if you, do you remember that scene?
I do. That was actually one of my very next questions was how, you know, designing a sound for a movie within a movie that you know, has to, it takes on the life of being that, or the TV show itself. You know, it's as you mentioned, it is portrayed to us as if we're almost watching it instead of the way that a real movie set would, or a television set would look, would sound.
And exactly. And so I discussed that with Quentin and Fred Raskin, and it was like, hey, let's try playing it opposite. You know, let's try, you know, here, let me sketch out something and tell me how this feels, you know. But it's much more interesting to play it not for its realism, but for the reality that it imposes on Quentin's movie within a movie, you know. That's the beauty that Quentin has, is he really makes films so that he can experiment with, you know, with storytelling, you know. And in terms of sound, what that means is music, sound design, and micro details that we get, you know, from Foley tracks and just attention to detail. He has, you know, with Quentin, he has visual attention to detail. And so it's a natural to reinforce that with very micro details in the soundtrack.
So I have one more question for you.
Sure.
And I can't not talk to you and not mention probably one of my all-time favorite films, which is Cameron Crowe's Almost Famous, which I know you worked on as well.
Yeah.
Tell me about designing the sound for that movie. I can imagine that must have just been a tremendous experience in and of itself.
Well, I met Cameron Crowe on Jerry Maguire.
Mm-hmm.
And just if you ever want to do a piece on writer-directors, this is why I love them. You know, I could tell you that John Hughes taught me about comedy, and Oliver taught me about biopics and bending time. And, you know, with Oliver, we did things, you know, in JFK that nobody had done before. And we were like, Can you do that? Can you cut to somebody who's delivering a monologue, then cut to them and they're not moving their lips, but you continue the dialogue, and then you come back to them again and they're back in real time delivering dialogue again? And it was like, yeah, let's try that. Oh, that is cool. You know, I mean, we actually built a vocabulary that's now, you know, that other people took and took further, I guess. But, you know, it was like exploration time, you know, with Oliver. But with Cameron Crowe, you know, he said back in the day, my goal in being a writer, director, filmmaker is to put music to picture. And so, you know, Almost Famous was really, you know, it was, again, it played opposite. So what happens in Almost Famous is you're following the band. And mm-hmm. then soon as the band goes on stage and they say, and now they announce the band, they do a downbeat, you cut to the next scene. So it's a musical without the on camera, you know, scenes of actually shooting the concert scenes. You know, it would be like doing A Star Is Born and never having any of them sing a song, right. You know, or you know, so I love Cameron Crowe, but that's, you know, that's how he introduced himself, is I'm a guy that, you know, is doing this kind of work so I can put music to picture. And it was a great lesson, you know. But the kind of soundtrack, song-driven soundtracks, you know, I don't know if you like the film, but Natural Born Killers.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
There's more than 85 music starts in that movie.
Right. But that's like that's an acid trip of a film. So there has to be, you know, just the sounds there have to be insane. I mean, there's animal sounds in every scene. There's different kinds of music. I mean, it's acid trip is not, I mean, it's a word, but it's more impressionistic that way.
When we first played that movie for other producers in the studio, they were like, halfway in, they were like, stop, stop, stop. They're like, you know, they're like, we're looking at a new form of filmmaking here.
Yeah.
You know, and that was fun.
Yeah. Interestingly enough, also written by Quentin, or based on a story by Quentin.
Exactly. But if you ever, you know, if you ever want to muse over it, I'm happy to, you know, you can use me as a resource, Clarence. I'm at this point in my life where I love filmmaking and I have a really big picture view of it. Mm-hmm. You know, that's what I would say about Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. For me, the most interesting part about that movie was the chance to really see it first in, you know, in sort of script form, and then sit down, you know, and think about what would be important and what would be interesting, and having Quentin having selected all the music, it was really kind of great fun to then just kind of cherry pick through the other important sound effects things, get them right, you know, and then move on. But it's a very beginning to end. It's a fully executed, very high concept look at 1969, you know, in that style. And, you know, we researched quite a few films, and truly, you know, I loved Easy Rider. You know, mm-hmm. It's like, that to me, again, was like, you know, we went from lockdown cameras on tripods to, going on the road and having the ability to sort of fantasize about drugs and sex and rock and roll, you know, set it all to rock and roll. So, I'm so happy that people have enjoyed, you know, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. And I think that sound plays a very significant role completing the picture of 1969. And, but it does play against reality in many areas, more so than it's faithful to that. So just like the end of the movie is Quentin's fantasy of what might or could have been a different result of that terrible night, The sound plays quite a bit against things. And yet, anyway, I don't want to ramble on too much, but, you know.
This is great. I got to tell you, I have spoken with very few people who have worked in crafts on films that love the art, number one, and love their film as much as I can sense from you. This has been a tremendous opportunity. This has been a really great conversation.
Okay. And as I say, Clarence, if you're, you know, I'm willing to talk to you off the record just to give you background on other things. You know, I watch a lot of movies. I have an Atmos home studio at my house in Pagan Canyon, and that's where I do most of my design work and sketch work. But it's a great place to sort of, it's like my little design laboratory, you know, and I spend a lot of time taking apart films and looking at things and thinking the way I think about my films, which is, you know, really big picture shapes and designs and things. So